Good morning. Welcome. My name is Robin Proud. I'm a member of the program committee. Welcome to Prairie. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. The opening words will be read by Dean Schroeder.
The opening words are by Toni Morrison. A writer's life and work are not a gift to mankind. They are a necessity.
Bob and Barb Park will do the chalice lighting and read the chalice lighting word.
This is by Toni Morrison from Oprah Magazine. I tell my students, when you get these jobs that you have been so brilliantly trained for, just remember that your real job is that if you are free, you need to free somebody else. If you have some power, then your job is to empower somebody else. It's not just a grab bag candy game.
It's an honor to have today our presenter, Sandra Adele. She is the F.U. Bascom Professor of Afro-American Studies at the UW-Madison. She teaches African-American literature. She's the author of numerous publications, including one on Toni Morrison, and a memoir titled Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen. So please welcome Sandra Adele.
And it's really a delight. I love my job. I really love teaching. But it's a delight to be around grown people. And I was so surprised yesterday when I got an email message from Carlos Moshe. It's like, am I sharing the stage with him? Oh, my God. Thank you so much. It's just such an honor. I want to start by, there are a lot of things that I can back up a little bit, a lot of things that I don't have to say to you because you all know what literary allusions are, you know what myth and legends are, this is one, people often ask me, you know, what is my favorite book, and it's kind of hard sometimes to respond to, but I think about what I teach over and over again, especially to my freshmen and then the upper level courses in Toni Morrison, and it is Song of Solomon. The other one is Jazz, which is a much more complicated text in many ways because it's an experiment in writing. But this one is so loaded with myth and legend. And, you know, it sent me to the Bible to read the Song of Solomon and a couple of other things that I didn't get too well. But the Song of Solomon in the Bible is a love story. And then when I get to this book, I wonder, where is the love between the two major people, Macon Dead and his wife Ruth? And I tell the students, when you read these books, find the love. So you find it in other places, in other characters. It's just woven, interwoven with not only allusions, literary allusions, but what we call intertextuality in literary studies. And that is that you've got other texts woven into this. And those of you who've read it, I'm sure you found lots. If you know much about myth, the Odyssey, for example, because this character, Milkman Dead, is on an odyssey. He is on a search. He doesn't know it. He thinks he's looking for gold, but it becomes a search for himself. But among the things that are so intriguing with the way that Morrison situates this work or engages with the Bible is the naming. You have a character named Macon Dead. You've got Hagar, Ruth, Reba, and then a character who is the largest one in my imagination, her name is Pilot. How did these characters get their names? So in the naming, if those of you have the book, you want to look at it, it's on pages 18 and 19, and this is where Morrison plays around with this whole genealogy. And I'll just read a little bit on, and it is how Macon Dead, how that name came to be. A literal slip of the pen handed to his father on a piece of paper. And this is where The Freedmen's Bureau, some of the old soldiers, and half of them were not literate, were writing and putting in a log the names of the newly freed slaves. A literal slip of the pen handed to his father on a piece of paper, and which he handed on to his only son, and his son likewise handed on to his. Macon dead, who begat the second Macon dead, who married Ruth Foster dead, and begat Magdalene called Lena dead, and First Corinthians dead, and when the part of the world that mattered as milkman dead, and as if that were not enough, a sister named Pilate dead. Now, how was the naming, how did the naming happen? After Macon dead, the first Macon dead, his wife died in childbirth. And there was a tradition, and that was that you name the, not the first son, but all the other subsequent children by taking your hand, finger through the Bible and pointing to a section in the Bible, and where it lands is where what you name. So, the next part, and this is Macon dead after the wife died. He had cooperated as a young father with the blind selection of names from the Bible for every child other than the first male. How his father, confused and melancholy, this is the second Macon dead, how his father, confused and melancholy over his wife's death in childbirth, had thumbed through the Bible, and since he could not read a word, chosen a group of letters that seemed to him strong and handsome, saw in them a large figure that looked like a tree hanging in some princely but protective way over a row of smaller trees. And that's Morrison describing the character Pilate dead. And I skip a little bit. That's the baby's name. Now he's moving his hand down the Bible. That's the baby's name. The midwife says, "You want this for a baby's name?" He says, "I want that for the baby's name. Say it." She says, "You can't name the baby this." He says, "Say it." She says, "It's a man's name. Say it." She says, "Pilate." "What?" "Pilate. You wrote down Pilate." He says, "Like a riverboat, Pilate?" "No, like no river, not like no riverboat, Pilate. Like a Christ-killing Pilate. You can't get much worse than that for a name and a baby girl at that." He says, "That's where my finger went down at." She said, "Well, your brain ain't got to follow it. You don't want to give this motherless child the name of the man that killed Jesus, do you?" He says, "I asked Jesus to save my wife. Careful, Macon. I asked him all night long. He give you your baby." "Yes, he did. Baby named Pilate." She says, "Jesus, have mercy." The opening scene is pretty dramatic. You have a man standing on the roof of a hospital called Mercy Hospital. Of course, the black folks called it No Mercy Hospital because black people weren't allowed in it. And he has left a notice that he's going to fly away. Who picked that hymn, the song that we sang earlier? That was wonderful. Because everything in that hymn speaks to what's in this story. Milkman trying to find himself, you know, at last, finally. So anyway, in the opening scene then, you have this man, his name is Mr. Smith, and the opening lines are, "The North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance agent promised to fly from Mercy to the other side of Lake Superior at 3 o'clock. 2 days before the event was to take place, he tacked a note on the door of his little house. At 3 o'clock p.m. on Wednesday, the 18th of February, 1931. So we have a date. This novel moves from 1931 through around 1963. "I will take off from Mercy and fly away on my own wings. Please forgive me. I loved you all." So there you got a different kind of love, but it's a very deadly love that he's talking about. He didn't draw as big a crowd as Lindbergh had 4 years earlier. Not more than 40 or 50 people showed up because it was already 11 o'clock in the morning on the very Wednesday he had chosen for his flight before anybody read the note. But those people who have gathered are looking up at him. He has beautiful, beautiful Red Wing. I'm sorry, Blue Wings that he's made, he's manufactured. And so they're waiting for him to take off. In the meantime, you have things going on the ground. Ruth dead, and her daughters, Magdalene, called Lena, and First Corinthians are there, and they have baskets of flower petals that they make. This is what they sit. They're cloistered women, pretty much. They sit in this house that's overseen by this, abusive husband and father. And what they spend their time doing is making velvet rose petals and velvet roses. So now you've got a colorful scene. The man on the roof with his wings, blue wings, and there's a lot of blue in this story. And the women, there's a snow on the ground, and the women with these rose petals that get tipped over, and all of a sudden people are forgetting about the man up on the roof because they got to help the girls pick up these rose petals to put them back into the basket because they sell them at the local store. And then suddenly a woman named Pilate comes, and she begins to sing the Sugar Man song, and thankfully I cannot sing, I will not try this, and we could not find a Sugar Man song. Oh, Sugar Man done fly away. Sugar Man done gone. Sugar Man cut across the sky. Sugar Man gone home. Now she's standing, she's the outcast in the neighborhood. You know, she makes wine that she doesn't drink, but she sells it. Her brother hates her. He hates making that, hates just about everybody. But the song, there's something, the quality in that voice, that he hears it. Mr. Smith does. And he flies. He leaps. Of course, one of the guys said, well, he went splat. You didn't fly very far. But there is that reference already to flying, to song. What does it bring to mind? When you're singing, when you have that voice in mythology, the sirens. What do the sirens do? Their voices attract the men, and they die. They end up getting killed. But in this case, it's like he heard the sound. Like, I wanted to fly away with that sound, with your plane of solace, beautiful. And so her voice. Throughout this novel, you have song and singing. Pilate's voice attracts her brother, who hates her. And at one point, he goes and sneaks to where she lives on the other side of town, and just listens. He misses her, even though he hates her, but he listens. And just watches the three women who live in the house. That's Reba, that's Pilate, her daughter Reba, and the granddaughter Hagar. They're singing. And so song and sight and smell run throughout the novel. I call it synesthetic. You've got all of these senses, a sense of a kind of tactileness. Ginger, the smell of ginger permeates the novel. To the point where Morrison describes it, because I get deep into this stuff, that I can smell the ginger and then I go eat some fresh ginger, some ginger cookies or something. I get hungry. But so you have that opening scene. Now let me just give you a little capsule of what's happening in the story. Macon dead, that's the father, and Pilate were raised on a farm with the father. Macon did, and that would be Pilate's grandfather. Milkman's grandfather. They owned the farm, but the white people were trying to take it from them. So the father sat on a fence with a shotgun trying to protect his land. The white men snuck up behind him and shot him, this is what they both remember, that they saw their father being blown away. Pilate says he flew 5 feet off the fence before he died. Now they took off, they ran away, and they had to be hidden away because they had seen what had happened. And so there's an old lady, the midwife, who gave birth who brought the baby Pilate into the world, hides them in a house. Later on in the novel, we find out that she's still alive because he goes looking, Milkman does, the son, goes looking for, he thinks he's looking for gold, but he's going looking for Circe to find out where this cave is that the kids hid in at one point, where there was an old man, an old white man in there, they thought that the old white man was going to attack him, and they killed him. And there were little bags of gold in there, or so they thought there were little bags of gold in there. Macon, the father, thinks that his sister, Pilot, stole the gold, and she has it hanging in a sack in her house. He doesn't know about this until his son tells him, because his son has been in the house and says, well, you know, there's a sack of gold in the house. We think it's gold. So everybody's looking for this gold. So now you've got Jason and the Argonauts on this quest for gold, but it becomes a quest for his identity. He gets to Circe's house, to this old house where they once stayed in when they were children. They were hidden in that house. Circe has been living in that house for years, and she's a very old lady now. The house has dogs in it. He says when he came into the house, the narrator says when Milkman finds the house, and this is in the south now, he's moved from Michigan to the south, that the smell of the dogs was overwhelming. But then he gets into the house, and all of a sudden there's this breeze, and you've got the smell of ginger, a sweet smell. And then the old lady, Circe, comes up the steps, and he says he sees this old lady grinning, and she's like a corpse. And she grabs and hugs him, and he says, I saw all the witches I've ever dreamed of in my life, and he goes on with those, all kinds of witches. And he said, I woke up. Usually I have an erection. He said, all I had was the erection when the old lady hugs him. But he gets into the house, and he begins to hear more of the story of his father and Pilot. And what happened in their lives. So now he's on a search and a quest for his genealogy, which takes him to Danville, Virginia, and a place called Shalimar, which they call Solomon, and there are all of these Solomons in the small town. He's also got somebody chasing him, and this is Guitar. Now, Guitar, a guy named Guitar, is part of a group that's called the 7 Days. This is why Mr. Smith jumped off the hospital roof, because he couldn't take what was happening anymore. Every time somebody killed a black person, every time a white person killed a black person, they would find a random white person and kill that person, and it's a revenge killing. It pretty much the same way, but it was a secret society. When Emmett Till was murdered, for example, they talk about Emmett Till in the story. Some little white kid was found dead in the playground, killed in a similar fashion. But that was their way of revenge. And so these men who vowed to revenge out of love, they say, to revenge black folks, are going crazy. Guitar now is on a search for... He's following in the trails of Milkman, who's in the south now, going through the woods and looking for, you know, the gingerbread house, which is Circe's house. He's on the trail because he needs the gold to help finance, because they think they've got gold, to help finance the activities of the 7 Days. So that's part, in a nutshell, some of the story. There's much more in it because it unweaves and unravels in such a fascinating way. So, but among the other things, then, you have the daughters. I told you about the naming. Singing and songs are interweaved all the way through this work. In the Sugar Man song in the opening scene, and then there's a children's round in the last part of the novel, and that is where Milkman finally begins to understand his genealogy. And it's a round. So the children are playing games, and he's listening. All of a sudden, he's becoming very aware of himself and his role in the family. And he's coming into himself, because he no longer wants to be like his father. He was a very shallow person in many ways, following in his father's footsteps. But now it's like, it's all about me and myself and my relation to the world. So there's this long story about another ancestor named Jake, and a man named Solomon, who had 21 children. And Solomon flew away. Now, how did he literally fly within the context of the story, or did he run away? Because don't forget that song, I'll Fly Away. the spiritual I'll Fly Away was code for, you know, we're leaving tonight, we're out of here. Near the end of the story then, Milkman is sitting there listening to the children, and he gets this whole genealogy. Rhina's Gulch. Rhina was the wife that was left behind with the 20-something children, 21 children, but one child was left behind. Now, the story in this round is that when Solomon flew away, he dropped one of the children. He flew in the air and just dropped one child down, left him, Jake. So he says, this is near the end, Milkman's scalp began to tingle when he hears the children singing the round. Jay, the only song of Solomon? The only son of Solomon. Was that Jake, the only son of Solomon? Jake. He strained to hear the children. That was one of the people he was looking for. A man named Jake who lived in Shalimar, as did his wife, Singh. And Singh is an Indian woman. And there's another woman named Bird, Mrs. Bird, who makes ginger cookies. He sat up and waited for the children to begin the verse again. Come booba yale, come booba tambe. It sounded like and didn't make sense. But another line, black lady fell down on the ground, was clear enough. There was another string of nonsense words then, threw her body all around. Now the child in the center began whirling, spinning to lyrics sung in a different, faster tempo. Solomon and Rhina, balale, shalut. Solomon again and Rhina? Rhina? Why did the second name sound so familiar? Solomon and Rhina, the woods, the hunt, Solomon's leap, and Rhina's gulch, places they went to or passed through the night they shot the bobcat. There's a wonderful scene of the shooting of and the skinning of the bobcat and in a hunt that he goes on with some of the people there in the South. And I just wonder, how did Toni Morrison manage that? I know you can get an anatomy book, you know, and look and see how to skin a bobcat. You can almost smell it. That's what I mean by the tactileness of the work. But this is near the end of the story. Guitar catches up with him. Don't forget, they've been brothers, like brothers all for throughout most of the story, until Milkman finds out what he's doing, what Guitar is doing with this revenge killing. And the very last part of it is that Milkman is leaping off the cliff and saying, man, you want me? Take me. And he flies. The last part of it is he's flying into the loving arms of his brother. And there are a couple of other things that I want to, scenes that I want to read, especially when Pilate gives the, speaks about her daughter Hagar, who dies. Now, Hagar and Milkman are first cousins, but they have a love relationship, and he dumps her, and she just goes off the deep end and ends up dying. Questions? We all know that, I don't have to tell you about the three channels that we had, TV and, you know, radio and all that kind of stuff. But in the household, she said her mother was her mother sang all the time. And so there are a couple of things. Her mother singing, just songs, just making up stuff. And the storytelling that they heard, because this was really, we're talking about the age of the oral culture when we sat around and told stories. And then the other part was that her grandfather read the Bible over and over again, and she read the Bible to her grandmother. And so I think that what she pulled together, because I have not been able to find the lyrics, we haven't found any music to this. I think she invented these, but I think the invention would be, you know, the creation is, she's pulling from a lot of myths, and she's making up language here too. Other questions? It's so, you know, it's open, and she leaves, she often leaves her stories open. Mm-hmm. So she says, for example, in the end, you know, don't forget, keep in mind that you've got two people who are, you know, are antagonists now. And the last part of it is, over here, brother man, this is Milkman. He's on the cliff, and Guitar's trying to kill him. Over here, brother man, can you see me? Milkman cupped his mouth with one hand and waved the other over his head. Here I am. Am, said the rocks. He's on the cliff. He's in the gulch. You want me, huh? You want my life? Life, 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 life. Squatting on the edge of the other flat-headed rock with only the night to cover him, Guitar smiled over the barrel of his rifle. My man, he murmured to himself. My main man. He put the rifle on the ground and stood up. Milkman stopped waving and narrowed his eyes. He could just make out Guitar's head and shoulders in the dark. You want my life? Milkman was not shouting now. You need it? Here, without wiping away the tears, taking a deep breath, or even bending his knees, he leaped as fleet and bright as a lodestar. He wheeled toward Guitar, and it did not matter which one of them would give up his ghost in the killing arms of his brother. For now, he knew what Shalimar knew, the town of Shalimar knew, where all this singing and about flying is going on. If you surrender to the air, you could ride it. That's how she ends it. But it takes it through, you know, from 1931 to around 1963. I think that what this book does for me, it puts me in another world. And that's what I like. This is what I try to get my students to understand. It's becoming very difficult because they have so many distractions now. But for me, literature is taking me out of my everyday reality into a world that some of these worlds I don't want to be in, you know. But this one is so mythical. I mean, these characters are so incredibly beautiful to me. And that's what literature does for me. It's transcendence. I guess the thing that appeals to me, you know, I'm trained as a literary scholar, and there is a level there that separates me from the deep personal. I mean, there are things in my personal life. Those of you who read Confessions of a Slot Machine Queen, that I don't want to deal with. I don't want to find it in the text. I want to be taken somewhere else. And anywhere out of this world, and this is one that does it so beautifully because it's got African myths, it's got the Bible, you know, it's got, you know, Greek mythology. Circe, for example. I mean, who is Circe in mythology? Pilate doesn't have a belly button, and that takes us to the idea of the Omphalos. You know, why doesn't she not have a belly button? So there's all of this tremendous magic in this work that is not part of my reality. Now I can connect because I know some of these myths and stories, and it's also wonderful to pick up a book. Finally, this is her third book, and I came up in a time, most of us came up in a time when you couldn't, it was very hard to find books by and about African Americans. And now it's like there's this blossoming, and she, Toni Morrison, helped to open the way for so many other writers and readers. So I guess the personal connection is just with me and the work. Mm-hmm. And magical realism in the South, the Latin American writers were very important to Morrison. She read everything and everybody, you know. I mean, Morrison's degree, her master's degree, was in modern American literature, Faulkner, Virginia Woolf. She got that degree at Cornell University. And, you know, again, for writers, aspiring writers, and might be some in the room, you all know, writers read other writers. That's part of the craft of learning the craft of writing. Actually, yes, the last three or four books are shorter, for one thing. I mean, you know, she was writing until she's in her 80s, and that's a really inspiration. You know, I just want to keep going. And so, in fact, with this generation of writers, readers rather, I would not start with my freshman with this book or any of the other books. The Bluest Eye, for example, how many of you read that? That's a hard book for young people. We've got kids coming in with all kinds of traumatic stuff, you know, in the university, so into our classes. So, you know, the graphic scene of the rape and the incest. There's a lot of incest in this book, too, by the way, but it's differently, rendered differently. So I would not start. I've been rethinking things. I would not start with that. There's a book called God Help the Child, which is less than 200 pages, and it's much more accessible, and that's the entryway for freshman students to read and to move on with other works. Beloved, I don't teach that anymore. It's just too complicated. I've had, you know, really experienced readers. My sister is a very, very good reader, and she said I couldn't get through the first part of it. You know, and so I have to wage, you know, what are the experienced readers having difficulty with? If they're having troubles, what do I expect from my students? This is the scene with of Pilate coming to the funeral of her granddaughter Hagar. And it's through the service. She says, halfway up the aisle, she stopped, lifted a finger, and pointed. Then slowly, although her breathing was fast and shallow, she lowered her hand to her side. It was strange, the languorous, limp hand coming to rest at her side while her breathing was coming so quick and fast. Mercy, she said again, but she whispered it now. The mortician scurried toward her and touched her elbow. She moved away from him and went right up to the pier. Dear, she, Miss Meyer, maybe, she tilted her head and looked down. Her earring grazed her shoulder. Out of the total blackness of her clothes, it blazed like a star. The mortician tried to approach her again and moved closer, but when he saw her inky black berry black lips, her cloudy, rainy eyes, the wonderful brass box hanging from her ear, he stepped back and looked at the floor. Mercy? Now she was asking a question. Mercy? It was not enough. The word needed a bottom, a frame. She straightened up, held her head high, and transformed the plea into a note. In a clear bluebell voice, she sang it out. The one word held so long, it became a sentence. And before the last syllable had died, in the corners of the room, she was answered in a sweet soprano. That's her daughter. I hear you. And they're mourning the granddaughter, Reba. The people turned around. Reba had entered and was singing, too. Pilate never acknowledged her entrance, nor missed a beat. She simply repeated the word, mercy. And Reba replied, the daughter standing at the back of the chapel, the mother in the front, they sang, in the midnight, in the nighttime, mercy. In the darkness, mercy. In the morning, mercy. At my bedside, mercy. On my knees now, mercy, mercy, mercy. They stopped at the same time in a high silence. Pilate reached out her hand and placed three fingers on the edge of the coffin. Now she addressed her words to the woman bordered in gray satin who lay before her. Softly, privately, she sang to Hagar the very same assurance she had promised her when she was a little girl. Who's been bothering my sweet little lumpkin? Who's been bothering my baby? Who's been bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin? Who's been bothering my baby girl? Somebody's been bothering my sweet little lumpkin. Somebody's been bothering my baby girl. I'll find who's bothering my sweet sugar lumpkin. I'll find somebody who's bothering my baby girl. My baby girl. The three words were still pumping in her throat as she turned away from that coffin, looking about her at the faces of the people seated in the pews. And she fastened on the first pair of eyes that were directed toward her. She nodded at that face and said, my baby girl. She looked for another pair of eyes and told him also, my baby girl. Moving back down the aisle, she told each face turned toward her the same piece of news. My baby girl, my baby girl, that's my baby girl. My baby girl, my baby girl, my baby girl. Suddenly, like an elephant who had just found his anger and lifted his trunk over the heads of the little men who want his teeth, or his hide, or his flesh, or his amazing strength. Pilate trumpeted for the sky itself to hear. And she was loved. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Now, for anybody who doesn't understand why audiobooks can add a lot, now, this was great because we had a physical performance, too, but when I read those lines of what she says, it was didn't have the impact that you gave. So I think that Toni Morrison might be a good one. Their Eyes Were Watching God, read by Ruby Dee, is a performance that I could never match reading, trying to read the text. So I'm sure there are some excellent readers of Toni Morrison, for those of you, too, that are driving around a lot and don't feel you have time to read. And for our closing words, will be read by Millie Moffitt, if you'd like to come up.
The closing words are by Toni Morrison. We die that we may be the meaning of life, but we do language that may be the measure of our lives.
Now, greet your neighbors. Join us for coffee and conversation.